this particular episode, we are going to be covering through just the general knowledge or what we know of, getting a real debrief of what we really know about West African empires, not going into as much detail as we are in another episode, but you will get the general idea of where we're trying to establish them as their own foundation for these empires. West Africa is lush with great empires. Lou, can you name a few that you might want to have a great stab at as far as like who really stood out to you?
Yes. Hold on. Well, first, I wanted to rezone West Africa and Central Africa. And then once we firmly know what West Africa really is, I wanted to give credit to the Ashanti, the Songhai, and the Dogon tribes, because those motherfuckers are putting in scientific work all over the place.
Absolutely.
Like, the treatment of witchcraft, I believe, in Ashanti, like they had no death penalty except for witchcraft. And I found that very interesting that no one points that out either, because like a whole empire, no capital punishment except for one thing, which is brainwashing people using charms and spells, witchcraft. Now, when they talk about modern Africa, they say all Africans are backward savages who are doing what? Practicing witchcraft. So because they destabilized that one empire, there's a stigma on modern Africans that Europeans put on them. And the modern Africans are so anti-black, they don't want to discuss that stigma that wasn't there 1,000 years ago.
Right. That's interesting. I actually had a note on somebody, because there was a particular Oba. And let me see if I can find it. But he basically established himself as a great ruler, and also he used a great deal of sorcery. And I always beg the question if we were to get these, you know, there's been a great deal of fight to get these Benin bronzes back to Africa. And I think that's a great noble gesture to make, because that should be done. It's not even really a gesture. It should be done. You know, it's justifiable in that way. But at the same time, the question is likely where do we establish, or who do we vet to really house these artifacts, knowing that in some instances, some of the locals have been shunning them? I find that kind of interesting, because we do need to vet that in that particular case.
Well, my logical assumption is because they were not using witchcraft for evil in ancient Africa, that even if there was legalized witchcraft, it was for the benefit of the people. Like the, what was it? The religious system. Like the religious system over in ancient Kemet. Like every superstition they had is for the benefit of their people. But somehow, they're just barbarians and savages, and there's no logic to it. Like, there's always a logic to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that more so, again, when we do establish these people, giving them back what belongs to them, we do need to vet where these artifacts are being housed, and particularly in a more safe general area where it could be also established and militarized around to be protected, because we do know that even in, I think it was 2012, that there was a lot of extremists that went even into certain parts of Africa. Timbuktu really stood out as well, and they just completely destroyed a lot of historical artifacts and monuments and mausoleums in that sense. But yeah, that needs to be protected in some way, in some fashion. To establish that protection, it goes back to, again, I think I said it was Timbuktu for just one particular area. 14 to about 16 mausoleums, which form part of the World Heritage Site that is recognized under UNESCO. They were destroyed within the context of armed conflict and civil unrest. Attacks were targeted by Al-Farouk, and he completely destroyed a lot of these artifacts and mausoleums, and about an estimated 4,203 manuscripts from the Institute of Higher Islamic Studies and Research, Ahmed Baba, were burnt or stolen by the armed groups. In 2016, the International Criminal Court convicted Al-Farouk Ahmad for directing these attacks in which destroyed a lot of these monuments. So again, when I'm talking about these iconographies, these artifacts, it is coming from outsiders, it's coming from these extremists, it's coming from even the locals. It really needs to be established that we have a vetted force behind protecting this, because when it comes down to this civil unrest or even religion, when a religion is involved, people care less about the history. They care more about what their religion is catered to, and that is the destruction of what they view as evil or what have you. Did you remember hearing about that in 2012, Lou?
Negative.
Oh, no?
Could you go into detail on that one?
Okay. Yeah, that happened a while ago. I remember hearing about that. And I don't even know if I heard about it at that particular moment, but I know I did remember hearing about it much later, and I just thought it was crazy. But then going back to the Dogon, though, when it comes to, I want to say they're facts. I don't even want to call it mythology, because again, they've had a lot of things already figured out well before Europeans, or where they try to give Europeans credit for astronomical achievements, were already made and already found in Africa, whether that was through the Dogon or some other tribe as well. We have to remember that some of the earliest astronomical observatories were in Africa. I can think of, I think the oldest is in South Africa, called Adam's Calendar. There's another old one as well, closer to Egypt, Nabata Playa, that observatory as well. But and then they try to also recognize the one in Stonehenge as a possible observatory. I don't know how old that is, but again, if we're talking about a particular period of time, we know who could have been involved with that as well, if that was indeed an observatory.
Stonehenge goes back about 12,000 BC, if I recall correctly.
Wait, I'm hearing you kind of sound a little muffled.
Stonehenge goes back about 12,000 BC, if I recall correctly on the date.
Oh, okay, 12,000 BC. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, so that would definitely be Black Africans.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, when we're really digging into the historical documents of these, it gets well established. We know that some of the, again, the earliest astronomical observatories and studies were in Africa. Even, again, going back to Egypt, when we're talking about the Sopdet star and how the observation of that led to them being able to establish not only by way of the stars, but more in a way of a mathematical breakdown and how they wanted to establish themselves and advance as a civilization. Again, when I'm talking about the Sirius star or the Sopdet star, in which they called it, that Sirius as a double star is unknown. Astronomy is of very little importance in religion. Dogon society has no initiatory secrets beyond the complete mastery of public known texts. the Dogon were just very much established people when they were when it came to the observation of these stars. What do you think about that notion that you know, they'd say there was aliens involved?
That's a negative, because I already went through that UFO phase. Aliens might definitely exist, but so far it looks like they're ignoring us.
Mm-hmm.
Stonehenge was built in six stages between 3000 and 1520 BCE, and that is after the Cheddarman people migrated into Europe, like the UK region, about 10,000 BC. So that's exactly what I thought it was. It was the culmination of their culture in that region. And they would be African if they showed up at 10,000 BC. Okay. So the other thing about the Dogon culture, the Dogon, I remember a distinct story of a European meeting them and describing their astronomy system. And he said they trained for much of their life from an early age to have incredible enhanced night vision. So they were looking at the stars with their naked eye under different climate conditions than we have today. So less pollution, less interference from dust and other things in the Green Sahara. So they were able to map out not only the Sirius star, which is what you were posting about, the Mayans also aligning their systems with the star called Sirius. The Egyptians were doing the same thing. So Mayans, Egyptians, and Dogons aligning to the same star system collectively. And the Dogon were the ones who told the European that it was a binary star system, which is very intriguing, because he noted that before modern, telescopes, before modern telescopes actually focused on the Sirius system and found out it is indeed a binary star system. But you cannot see that from Earth. Your eye, if you did, your eyesight would have to be beyond human. So I found that very intriguing that they were able to confirm that who knows how many thousands of years before modern optics, and they don't have a culture of making high-quality glass optics or crystal optics like the Mesopotamians. So I'm like, hey, if their evolutionary system works, why change it?
Right. Right. I mean, and they're remarkable people because, you know, they completely flabbergasted the Europeans, I guess, or the scholars in that sense, when, you know, they were established themselves as knowledgeable people who knew about star systems, well before they, within their system, defined it and gave credit to it. It's also in making that connection between, as you referenced with the observation of the stars, like you said, Sirius, which they call Soptet again, and at least in Egypt, they called it that. It has long been pointed out that the Dogon bury, voodoo pottery, and they are by no means the only ones. This custom has been compared with that of the Egyptians who place, what is it called?
Shabdi?
Yeah, Shabdis. In the burial as well, and these names of their enemies and bowls in which they buried at specific points. You know, it's something, now that I think about it, when we're talking about this establishment of the bowls in which they just reference as well, you know, the so-called, Egyptian witchcraft will also establish a way in which bowls were also used in a way for incoming invasions and enemies to thwart off in a rage of anger to, in a sense, control them. They would actually write on these bowls with like red paint and then do like a smashing before they went into war with these people. You know, when we're thinking about these, controlled rage or this breaking of art or, bowls or other miscellaneous things, we still do that
symbolic
today.
Symbolic object.
Right. We do that as a form of decompression. And they were doing that well before that, but they just had a whole ritual behind it first in order to establish themselves and give them, I guess, their decompression and an advantage. So they're not bringing so much emotion into it, but more so of a strategy.
Well, hold on. I think everyone would also need to know where the Dogon are currently located versus where they claim in their folklore they're traditionally originated. Because we need some background on these people.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm definitely get that established definitely tomorrow, do more of that research on the Dogon.
I can share what I've heard.
Oh, go ahead.
Based on my Megalake Chad Central Africa theory, the Dogon are on the exact western border of that cultural complex. So I'm not the least bit surprised that those people not only have advanced eugenics, which is the Spartan or the Maasai Kenyan system from Central Africa. I'm not surprised that they are astronomers, because that had to start using the Megalake navigation waterway system. You have to know where you are on a lake that is 3 days sailing across, and to do that, you use the stars on the water. Okay. And the third thing is they apparently pioneered and were the first culture to enter the Iron Age. But what modern archaeologists, the Europeans, are now saying is that tradition and the radiocarbon dating from their sites goes back 10,000 BC. So they entered the Iron Age way before the rest of the other Africans and the other out-of-African populations even entered the Bronze Age. It's like some people might have still been in the Stone Age. So if we were to figure out what cultural practices on the megalakes in Central Africa, the true Central Africa, led to them developing eugenics, astronomy, and ironsmithing, we have found the holy grail of human culture.
It's
not the Dogon, because they're a descendant population of some other group. So that's why I say we got to define that whole region. Like, they'll say, oh, the Dogon are Western African. I'm saying the Dogon are Central African types. We just haven't wrapped our head around that yet.
And I think we really need to define where that is. Again, migrations happen. One thing I've also noticed too is that you made that connection in reference to America. You know, it's kind of funny also that we also see a vast amount of totems in Africa. And where else do you see vast amount of totems? We see a lot of totems in America.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll see a vast amount of totems in Africa. And I would argue probably the second biggest place you'll find totems is in America.
Oh, yes. Oh, I was so happy to see those totems on the front porches of all those megastructures in Cameroon.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, again, we're talking about these totems. They have this, a lot of them have this stacking type of, establishment and visual. And often you'll see animals, and sometimes you'll see humans, or you'll see a combination of both. You see both in America and in Africa. You know, a lot of these things I don't believe in coincidences, you know.
Hold on. I would go even further and point out that the animal-headed figures of Kemetic Egypt and Mesopotamia are also totems. They're just not stationary.
Oh, okay. Yeah, absolute. I need to look at the Mesopotamian ones more often then. I need to establish that. If you got pictures of it, I would love to see it. But
hold on. Their deities are animal-headed people with, like, wings and
human bodies. Right.
Yeah, those are just more totems, but nobody wants to acknowledge that connection.
Oh, see? Yeah, absolutely. Because you always know when it's involving a combination of these figureheads of animals and humans, again, that was first established in Africa. Again, back to West Africa as well. We know that one of the great commodities in West Africa really held its own around rock salt and rice. So these were a lot of the things that established early Ghana empires, commodities in that way, really established themselves and really held a standard for them for who were the people who really brought prosperity into the region. Also with the iron welding as well. That's something I can't forget it also. Iron welding.
Yeah, that wait, hold on. Did you were you ever informed that King Tut's most prized item, he had two collections of prized items. One was about 100 golden boomerangs from Australia. Literally, Australian boomerangs were on the wall of the tomb when they opened it. So solid gold throwing sticks that return is how they described them. But the white people knew those are Australian Aboriginal African hunting tools. So that's his second most prized collection. The item he had on him when he was buried was his most prized object, an iron dagger. Like, so a solid iron dagger in the Bronze Age, and it was smelted, according to the metallurgy, in Western Africa, which is where you find the Dogon tribes of today. So they, I mean...
That's very correct.
But, it's very correct, but I'm just a bit flabbergasted as to how all the Afrocentrics didn't make that connection to Western African and ancient Kemet right off the rip. It was like, hey, King Tut, most famous guy ever dug up so far. He's holding a Western African dagger. What does that imply? Yeah. International trade between Africans, way before Europeans, way before the Bronze Age even ends. Wow. At the end of the Bronze Age, that's the first time white people enter Africa, the Sea Peoples. So yeah. 1200 BC is when the Bronze Age comes to a catastrophic and genocidal end. Why is he holding a West African dagger if Europeans brought civilization and trade to everybody in Africa?
Listen, that's what I'm talking about. You establish what the history is, essentially. So when they are establishing the history, they make it in their own revised vision, in that sense. So you can't really put too much stock because you know that even on the basis of language, again, there's going to be connections in West Africa language that goes back to even... what they call Afro-Asiatic languages, in which they have put front and center as well Egypt in there, or the Egyptian or Midjuniter in there as part of that Afro-Asiatic language, even though Semitic languages weren't introduced till much, much later. That wasn't established till about the first century BC. And yet and still we have the Egyptian Midjuniter language being established with Afro-Asiatic language as opposed to its affinity with other, I guess, Bantu languages as well. We can point out there's some Yoruba connection and also Wolof connections as well. We've also seen very early Somali connections. These are agenda fueled, obviously. So when we're talking about these connections, these are connections that we have to make for ourselves, and you know we can't really look to them to find that. We have to actually go and dig the information up, find the connection, and see here is front and center. You can't really have a debate about language, really. You know, if a word says a word and it means it's the same thing, that's where the affinity really aligns there.
Hold on. Speaking of that argument about language, I think we need to start putting our foot down and just saying that Bantu is the primordial language that they're describing in the the Semitic religions. When they say the Tower of Babel and that story about how language fractured, what they're saying is we had Bantu as a universal language and then it fractured. So we got to be more blunt. But we have all the advantage. We literally already won these debates. We're just telling the public at this point because everyone's behind the curve, and I don't see those degrees feeding us in the future with the way things are going right now.
Trey will be so ecstatic at that connection that we just made just now. Aroma, you can go.
Yeah, Lusofi, I just wanted to say right quick that King Tut dagger that you were talking about was actually made out of meteorite.
Yes, meteoric iron, which is even more significant than earthborn iron, because they weren't digging it up. What they're doing is they're doing, what's that word, geology. They're identifying earth ores versus purified iron from space ores. That's a whole different thing. That's a whole field of science, what they're doing. Yeah. So they're more advanced.
Say that again, Roma?
I said, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, but no one's acknowledged that that's what they did, even though they have the dagger and the metallurgy results of it. Oh, this is an earth iron. They're not just digging willy-nilly and then purifying it. What they're doing is specifically targeting ancient asteroid impact sites, such as where what is that? Mauritania. Remember, oh, have you seen the video of the guy going to Atlantis?
I think so.
Yeah, the reshot structure, it looks like an asteroid impact crater.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking by 100,000 BC, Earth-based humans had figured out if you just look for these giant craters, in the center of those craters, there's going to be a lump of something, and you want that something. So it's probably going to be iron from space.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Atlantis as well, also, again, people, West Africa, the thing about Atlantis is that if they, this mythology about Atlantis and the probability of at least one of the bases being established literally on the landscape or the continent of West Africa and possibly off of a later another land bridge as well. But as to the conversation on the one in Africa, again, you said that crater, there has been pottery found in and around that possible crater looking ruin. Could be a crater, possibly. Or, you know, what that reminds me of? It reminds me of the walls of Benin. Again, a circular structure covered by water. Very reminiscent of that to me. What do you think about that, Lou?
Well, based on the other videos on the white guy who went to Mauritania and actually visited where he thought Atlantis was, and he ended up in Atlantis. Before he departed on that trip into the middle of nowhere, a terraformed nowhere is where he arrived. Before he left the civilized part of Mauritania, they already showed him the local collection of seashell and ocean-based fossils. They've already tested and radiocarbon dated those fossils, and their conclusion was part of Mauritania used to be connected directly to the Atlantic Ocean to the west of them. So there was a massive waterway leading into the center of the country over to the reshot structure. So there's no debate on that. They know for a fact that is definitely Atlantis. It's like, uh-oh. Because that is described in the Plato mythology and the Herodotus mythology. Herodotus said he came down the Yellow Nile from Egypt he headed west across Libya on a river and ended up in Mauritania in Atlanta. So he said he sailed in from the east. And Plato says his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather is going back generations, said they sailed through Gibraltar, came down the Atlantic, and then sailed inward towards the east into Mauritania for days, then ended up in Atlantis. And both of them are literally coming to the same location. That is Mauritania. That is the reshot structure. And it used to be flooded. And it had animal life in the water. It wasn't a temporary situation. It was a flooded crater. And when the white guy got there, he pointed out specifically how strange the terrain was compared to all the rest of the African terrain around it. It had been literally manipulated by human hands over eons to level out the entire acreage for 100 kilometers in every direction. So not only is it an old structure, the black people lived there a long damn time and literally sculpted it flat. Like, wow. And then they built the rings around the crater. And then he still found the temple still standing in the center of the damn thing. He's like, wow. And he's like, how did no one find this? You can literally just read old Greek folklore and come right to it.
Yeah, and that's funny you brought up Herodotus as well. Herodotus did document the fact that the Egyptians were creating fleets through that strait as well, in between Spain and Africa, Morocco. And so that if there were to be, again, that strong current, and I don't want to say if that were, likelihood that they would get trapped up in that current, they would be well established to land right in the Americas. And a lot of them specifically right where the Olmec pyramids were built as well. So Herodotus did have that document as well. If anybody wanted to challenge me on that, I do have that as well to post on the Jumbotron. But yeah, again, that's always interesting.
Hold on. Can you find the Herodotus map I found years ago? Because I did not bookmark that. But he drew a map for ancient peoples. He said Atlantis was literally in West Africa on the map. So I was like, oh, so they already know.
Nah, I got to find that. Definitely got to find that. I'm going to bring that to Trey. Aromo's good with finding like crazy stuff too. Aromo might.
I've heard of that. I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it. Okay, I know he spoke. I know he spoke a lot about Atlantis.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that map already. I just didn't have my Pinterest account set up to bookmark it at the years back, so I lost a lot of valuable finds that I found on Google.
Dang. Have you guys seen the Inca Stone?
Inca Stone, no.
Sophie, have you seen it?
Negative.
I'll post some pictures. You need to see that. They're basically a bunch of stones that were found in the northern part of South America that depict a bunch of highly advanced ancient civilizations, and there's thousands of them. And one of the couple of things that they show an eighth continent. They also show humans riding on dinosaurs. I'll post some of them.
What?
Oh, wait a minute. I've seen the ones they recovered from Mexico with the T-Rex and the, what was that, club-tail dinosaur?
Wait, were they black?
Yes.
Yeah, that's probably it. One of the ways that we know that they're not forged is there was actually some Spanish explorers that saw them a few hundred years ago. And they talked about them, and they're done very well. It's not something that's crude. And there's thousands of them. So too many for you to fake.
Even more importantly, the depictions of how the dinosaurs are walking and interacting with each other on the figurines is accurate to what we know now in the end of this century, rather than what they were researching for the last 200 years of dinosaur research.
Yeah, they show triceratops. They show people riding on the dinosaurs. They show small people doing medical procedures, like doing surgery. I'll post some of them.
Go ahead, Lou.
They also showed a mother T-Rex defending its young from a pack of like Aztec or Mayan type warriors who were wearing the jaguar heads, and they were hunting the baby T-Rex, and a mother T-Rex was defending it. That is a concept alien to European researchers until they found the T-Rex curled around its eggs.
Yeah, something that if they find out to be, or if they end up being substantiated, it rewrites human history completely.
Oh yeah, and the Ankylosaurus. There was a depiction on one of the pieces of pottery or stones of an armored spiked dinosaur with a mace-like tail, and it was like attacking the warriors with the tail. And that specimen had never been collected on anywhere on Earth until this century. So, like, after 1950s, they found an Ankylosaurus and found the club tail attached, and they were completely shocked. But that was already on the pottery from, like, the 1930s. They said they found it.
Yeah, and like I said, there were Spanish explorers a few hundred years ago that saw them. I'll post the information on it.
Well, damn. Y'all going in
on and yeah, they show an eighth continent in the middle of where the other continents are in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, and there's been stories of that this supposed other landmass off the coast of West Africa in the Atlantic Ocean or what have you as well. Going back to Atlantis, a little bit of a curve because we are establishing it. And its origins in West Africa, but interesting to me what the concept for Atlantis might have been had Aquaman never came out, because we do know that Ryan Coogler was going to establish Atlantis as a rivalry with Wakanda. And I wonder if he was really going to go into like more of that historical basis for what we know Atlantis to be over in West Africa, if that story would have been totally changed from how they reappropriated it into a more Aztec culture.
Ooh, that's I don't know how to interpret that, because the Aztecs would have to also be black people, and I didn't even watch Black Panther 2 or whatever they call it.
Mm-hmm.
The trailer right off the rip was anti-black and insulting, so I just said, yeah, I'm boycotting that right off the rip. But now that we have all these genetic receipts and pottery and everything proving our point, when are they just going to correct and put some black people in the Aztec and Mayan and all the Olmec descended cultures? Because those are Luzia woman migrations that populated South America. So we can't say they didn't exist.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And we do know that they were a part of those populations. Again, they weren't the total population, but to completely ignore the fact that they were there is highly ignorant in that regard. So again, it's always funny also when we establish a lot of these kingdoms, empire, civilizations, they're likely or strategically always, centered around bodies of water. Just to establish a little bit more, the Songhai Empire, the capital was Gao. It was strategically positioned along the Niger River, and they used the river to extend the empire. They stretched it from modern day Niger to Nigeria, and is where they did a considerable amount of trade as well.
Hold on. Thank you for reminding me about the waterway system. We're still being downplayed on the Green Sahara period, like multiple periods of Green Sahara. So I'm thinking we might have to do a whole subsection on the impact of those waterways.
Because the ancient that's a nice one. Right.
Yeah. But what? You said swamps?
No. That's a nice subject matter. I like that topic.
Yeah, that is literally the core of the Central African hypothesis I have. Once I heard Lycurgus travel through all those regions really fast, like he went put himself in exile as a youth and he came back as a young man. So I was like, wait, how did he travel on land across all those continents and do it so quickly? And then the Plato thing hit and the Herodotus mat hit. And I was like, oh, he didn't travel on foot. He sailed through Africa to visit all those African kingdoms. I was like, gotcha. So we need to factor that in into the new world as well, because the ancient Egyptians were connected to Megalic Chad. Megalic Chad is connected to the Nigerian Cameroonian coast. The Nigerian Cameroonian coast is connected to the Atlantic Ocean, and that is connected to the cocaine that the ancient Egyptians were consuming on that. So we have a huge amount of influence just because those waterways exist.
Go ahead, Roman.
Atlantis. Mm-hmm. Atlantis is also reported to be connected back to Megalic Chad directly. It was a series of oases and rivers branching out into every part of Africa from Megalic Chad. And Megalic Chad is described as a lake so large and vast, it takes 3 days sailing to go from one end to the other. So that's a significant body of fucking water. The number of cultures around there include Noah, include the Nok culture, mm-hmm. include the Bantus that made Somali Ethiopians. Like, you got three cultures right there. Oh, not to mention the Maasai in Kenya come from that region, and the Spartans in Greece come from that region. So we're underselling what we have just on Green Sahara alone.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Romo.
Yeah, so as far as the Inca stones, I put four depictions of them in the Jumbotron. The first one, you can see two people doing surgery to someone. The second one, you can see someone riding a dinosaur. The fourth one, you see a bunch of dinosaurs, including Triceratops and some other ones. And then the third one, you see what's supposed to be eight continents, you can see a continent that looks like North America, one that looks like South America, one that looks like Australia, one that looks like Eurasia, one that looks like Africa, and then you see an eighth one in the middle.
Mm. Whoa, hold on.
Or not an eighth one, you know.
These long necks.
Yeah, it doesn't show Antarctica.
Oh, it doesn't show Antarctica.
No.
These long-necked animals is kind of...
Yeah, and then the thing about it is there's over 20,000 of them. So if it was a hoax, someone would have to hoax over 20,000 of them. And I can look up more information about it if you want. But yeah, before the guy that actually found them, in the year 1533, one of the conquistadors, Francisco Pizarro, he documented that he saw them back then.
He saw what exactly? Dinosaurs?
The Inca stones.
Oh, the Inca stones. Yeah, and to even see the Triceratops there on that stone. Very interesting.
Hold on. And that is not even the collection of pottery I was describing from Mexico. The ones with the T-Rex and the Ankylosaurus. That's a whole nother collection.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And they show the Aztec-type warriors interacting with the dinosaurs as part of rituals. So there's definitely something going on here now.
Yeah, do those look like the continents to you guys?
Yeah.
Roughly,
yeah.
Hold on. Speaking of continents, there is another map we need to acquire just as a nuclear device here. Temple of Horus, I believe it was called.
Okay. Yeah,
in the ancient Egypt, 3500 BC, I think it was. Could be 3300 or 3500. Mm-hmm. But they had a map, and on that map was something similar to these Inca stones, depicting Australia, North America, and South America. And inside the continental regions on that Egyptian map was the animals that were native to those regions, and they depict the horse in North America. So when they say the Spaniards brought the Mustang to North America, that is a lie, because the ancient Egyptians already had a concept of Mustangs living wild in America. And on South America, they had the alpaca. So all of these are accurate, and this map was found on a wall. It's not like a paper map. It's a full mosaic in a private dwelling in 33 to 3500 BC, ancient Kemet. And they're like, wow, and nobody's talking about this. I went to the page that hosted the image of the mosaic, and I was like, oh my God, that is a global map.
Why is no one mentioning that? There's a stone with some llamas on it, too.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, as far as the continents go, if these really are depictions that go back that many thousands of years, the continents change throughout time, so they wouldn't be shaped exactly how they are today.
Yeah, that's the Green Sahara period thing going on. If the Sahara can be completely dry today, but 10,000 or less years ago, it can be completely flooded and a vast meadowland where 7,000 BC Libyans are riding chariots across open meadows instead of sands. So I'm like, if 7000 BC is the earliest it switched over, everything we know about history has to be rewritten anyway. It's like that, like, wow, like all of our history is just wrong flat off. It's like Africans were developing chariots with horses in Africa, and they might have gotten the horses from America just right off the rip. It's like, damn.
Horses from America.
Yeah, just so you guys know, the name of the archaeologist that found his name was Javier Cabrera.
Okay.
And then the conquistador that saw them in 1535 was Francisco Pizarro.
Facts. That's what we like here. Straight facts.
I don't know. Those names sound pretty Afrocentric and pseudo to me.
Lou, you're a fool.
Hey, bro, we've been getting I listened to a month of you guys get called Crazy Hoteps.
And oh, then yeah.
When I jumped into the fray, now they're saying I'm just flat out crazy and, quote, the Hoteps even other Hoteps are afraid of. And I'm like,
yeah. And it's funny because when it comes to me, though, you know, I'm not even Trey's the one that really uses a whole lot of like Afrocentric scholars. I'll use them sometimes just to rub it in. But again, people don't even understand that a lot of the historical documents and the journals and the dissertations I'm using come from white America or white people in England, Cambridge University, again, UNESCO. Well, UNESCO is universal, but, you know, Harvard. A lot of these establishments are very catered to, I guess, Eurocentric. So it's just really just a double down when we're talking about how this Afrocentric thing is being corroborated by white scholars. It's like, how are we still establishing that it's a so-called Hotep bullshit?
And LaSophie, you said those sound kind of Afrocentric. If you want a white source, Ryan Drum, an American biologist, studied the stones at high magnification and found no evidence of forgery. And the source to that is Ryan Drum, the Cabrera Rocks Info Journal, number 17, May 1976, page 10.
Yes, absolute. I did come across that.
Emotional damage, my dude.
And also the Peruvian Times did an article about the surgical techniques on the stones. Some of the surgical techniques were not even known at the time. And that was in August. That was August 25th, 1972, Peruvian Times.
God damn.
Yeah, so I'm saying.
So what you're telling me is, yeah, unrivaled authenticity depicting dinosaurs. Human interactions with dinosaurs.
This is going to be a whole nother conversation, absolutely. We're going to have to get this into an interesting topic of like rogue theories, even though, quote unquote, they aren't really that rogue. Let's get into the fact that what really brought a lot of these West African empires or kingdoms to come to a decline?
Besides the Arab Muslim integration they attempted that backfired in their faces?
Yep.
Like horrifically backfired in their faces?
Yep.
I think I was booted over bringing up that timeline. 600 AD was the rise of Islam, but also the rise of the Mamluk slave revolt. And Mamluk means white mother or white woman, a.k.a. concubine, a.k.a. the white people that call themselves Anglo, that are supposed to be called Anglo-Arabs. So Mamluk is their official lineage title, but they do not use it because everyone knows it means sex slave, a white sex slave bought, purchased from other Anglo lineages, because the Arabs did not go into Ukraine or Scandinavia and take white women. They were brought to Black Arabia before 680. So yeah, the Hittites also confirmed that white men from Kazakhstan, or what was the quote? They are poor in everything except beautiful daughters. That's how they describe the people north of the Kazakh, northeast of the Kazakh mountains. They said they migrate up into the Caucasus mountains, drop their daughters off, get paid in gold powder and other goods, and then leave without their daughters. So it was like, wow. It was like, that's like 1100 BC. In the Caucasus Mountain Range. Black people are already writing that down. Yeah, these are white sex traffickers. And nobody wants to address that. Like, that's the origin of J1, J2 haplogroups, 1200 BC. Yeah, you were purchased for a fair price. No black people went over to Kazakhstan to raid and pillage and torture you to get your daughters to fuck them. Their own parents sold them. So we need to come to a full comprehension of the deviant behaviors we see in Anglo lineages, because it is ancestral to their lineages.
Yeah.
Hold on. I gotta add this other one. They recently, a few years ago, opened a Scandinavian Viking chief's the tomb. Like what? Mm-hmm. Yes, they opened one of those burial sites for a Viking chief. And they had three little treasure boxes about the size of your two hands is held in front of you. They opened them, and they were filled to the brim with Arabic minted coins. There were no Arabs in Scandinavia. The Vikings had sailed all the way around Spain. They left Scandinavia, came around Spain, visited the Hagia Sophia Temple in ancient Rome vandalized the wall with Viking runes saying something like Tom and Bob were here or some bullshit, and then made their way into Black Arabia, where they dropped off their captive white women, took money for them, and then went back, sailed back to Scandinavia to put it inside that chief's grave. So, yeah, they have a culture of pedophilia, sex trafficking, murder, incest. There's nothing they won't do. And then furthermore, when I was reading Herodotus again, he mentioned the Budini. The Budini are the native black people of Ukraine. So 400 BC, he says when he passed through Ukraine, the northern half of Ukraine had a mega city, like a million people in one place. The whole city is made completely of wooden structures called Gelonis, G-E-L-O-N-I-S. If you Google that, you can probably find his text on it. Real History Worldwide has the whole write-up and the translation. So the megacity of Gelonis is in the north. To the southern half of what we call Ukraine today was called the Wild Fields, and it was populated entirely by Scythians, who are white Kazakhstani people from Eurasia. And he said those people built nothing. That's what Herodotus is saying. The Scythians to the south built nothing, and even though they're called Scythians, they stole the name from a black man in northern part of Ukraine, a brother named Scythius. He's the black brother to another guy who built Gelonis. So he's like, yeah, they call themselves Scythians when they get here. They're not native Europeans, and they're not Scythians. They're just Kazakhstanis. So that's what your brain has to go to. Oh, wait, they're pretending to be black people in the north of Ukraine, and in the south, it's all slavery, torture, banditry. They're savages. They're barbaroi. Do not go through the south of Ukraine. The wild fields is what everyone called the region. It didn't even have a name anymore. It was so bad. But those Slavs, as other people called them, were trading white women in the south of Ukraine.
Even in my reading as well with the Vikings, yes, they did use a lot of their concubines as fodder for things that you've mentioned and other vile things that I'll probably...
Don't say concubines. They're not concubines yet. They're relatives. They're their children.
Well, there you go. Absolute.
Hold up. I got to add some more details on that Muslim thing, by the way. I got so off topic. The 600 AD rise of Islam and rise of the Mamluks, the white concubine lineages, Anglo-Arabs. Let's just keep it simple. Anglo-Arabs and Muslims arose at about the same time. Mm-hmm. The anti-blackness was inserted into Islam, from what I've found, because Islam is some sort of communist, oh, we all treat each other the same religion. I was like, okay, cool, that's close to Spartanism. Everyone's equal if you're the same lineage and background and have the same codification. Awesome. It starts to change after the Mamluk revolt. As soon as the white people got power in Arabia and kicked out the Maori Arabs, aka the Blackamoors, and pushed them into Western Africa, that's when the whole, oh, we have a caste system within Islam now. The whitest people are at the top. And Prophet Muhammad, in the Arabic text that I've been tossing my face, it says he is biracial. So Muhammad is not a black man. Muhammad is not a white concubine man. Muhammad is a mixed race biracial person, much like Alexander the Great or half the Roman. So it's the biracial element that always allies with the white supremacist element that took over black civilization to create the anti-black vandalism that always proceeds from all these cultures that are integrated. That's literally the beginning of the end for African Arabs. They keep shaking hands with their, quote, religious brothers, and those people come from a place that has just been usurped by white people. And all the biracials that are coming over saying, hey, we're a mix of you and we're a mix of them. We are like the Roma. As soon as the Africans turn their back and give them technology and access to those waterways and all those cultures and their language, they're going to wake up to a knife on their throat the next day. That's how it works. That's why Africa started to fall.
When you say they were pushed into Western Africa, are you talking about the Umayyad?
They call it the Umayyad, but I differentiate between the two groups. The Mamluk are Anglo-Arabs, and the original Arabs are the Black Maori, because they're called the Maori by the Greeks. So the Phoenician League and the Black Arabs, all of them are moving as refugees into Visigothic, Libya, and there are white people ruling Libya, they appeal to them for help to take back Arabia, and they are rejected. 680, in the middle of 600 AD, the white people laugh in their face and tell them, keep it moving. You ain't getting nothing back. We ain't going to help you fight other white people. So they go then down to Morocco, set up a front line, a base, and then go further south into West Africa to literally recruit troops to invade Spain in 711 AD. So that's the actual history of the Blackamoors. And when they get to Europe, they're still called Mori. But after they beat Spain and France, the white people in Spain and France, the Anglo-Visigoths, pushed out of there back into Scandinavia, the Germanic Gauls, who are black people, still above Rome, they joined the Blackamoor Rebellion against the Anglo-Visigoths. That's literally how it happened. That's where we get the word Black-a-Mori. Black is Old German, meaning dark like ink. Therefore, the German Gauls are the ones who are allying with the Black Arabs and the Black West Africans. It's European black people. You understand that concept?
No, I was trying to see if Romo was going to or wanted to respond, but yeah, we do see that decline in the various forms in which you have brought up as well. We also see a great decline when we're talking about the desertification. That was already well established before these empires came to, but also jealousy amongst the ranks, amongst the dynasties. There were successors who went a total opposite way in which the predecessor did establish itself. Sons being jealous one way or another. There was a particular one who brought down a particular empire. I can't think of the name right now. I think it might have been the Songhai Empire. Or was it?
You said what brought the empire down?
Basically, I was getting down to this, to the fact that jealousy and amongst the ranks would bring amongst a lot of that decline in empires, drought, invasions, civil wars. But a lot of that jealousy, you really seen, I think, it was with the Songhai Empire. It came into a collapse about 1591, and at that point became broken up into smaller kingdoms. That was right after the succession of Mohammed Turi. He was ruler from about 1492 to about 1528. Find full episodes of the podcast featuring Straight Facts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. Also, check out our Instagram for more Morocco Oris content, including the shop and our subscription service for exclusives. Peace, Mer. I'm on Morocco.